Welcome. I'm Isaac Dansky. Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast.
And I'm Patrick Gilbert.
So this is the first episode of a new podcast, and I think we're going to talk about all things marketing, agency, advertising, the news, stories. It'll be fun, but how did we get this name, How to Hide a Dead Body?
Yeah, it's definitely wordy. I love the name. It doesn't really have a whole lot to do with what we're talking about, but there's an old joke in the digital advertising space that the best place to hide a dead body is on the second page of Google search results. And it's not necessarily like a huge part of what we even do is optimizing search engine results or anything like that, but it is just a common theme that we've always joked about over the years. And I think if there's anything that we've carried with that over the years, it's the importance of advertising to become front and center. Essentially, you don't want to be putting your advertising where you could easily hide dead bodies.
Yeah, and I think it also plays into just the stories that we've heard and we've encountered over the years with clients, just like disasters, successes. We've learned a lot. And I was thinking that, I don't know, it's been 7 years we've been doing this, 6, 7 years we've been doing it. And I still feel like it's like every time I come into the office, it's day one, or it's not. I mean, I don't mean to like steal directly from Jeff Bezos, but I feel like it's still like our first year. You know, you're hustling, you have new clients, you have old clients. A lot of the same issues, they progress in complexity. There's like additional layers of what we're experiencing. But when I reflect, I realize like we really have learned a lot. Like we really have been through a lot of really interesting just experiences with clients and campaigns that we've run and results that we've analyzed. I think we have a lot to share with regards to that. So I think How to Hide a Dead Body is apropos, and we should jump into things. What's the first thing on the agenda?
So I think I like your point about how every day seems like day one, even today, right? So it's the Tuesday after Labor Day. We're still in this like transition. We're still in the middle of COVID, but as far as getting back to work and businesses opening back up, we're still in this transition period. 2021 is on the horizon. And like I came into work this morning feeling, you know, after a long weekend, feeling that, okay, now like this is essentially day one of a new week, of a new month of whatever. So I definitely agree with that point. And as far as what we want to cover today, I think it's important for us to talk about, given this world that is constantly changing and the media channels in which we advertise on and everything we do is constantly evolving. I think it's also important to first point out things that haven't changed. You mentioned over the course of 7 years, our jobs look very different. The work that we do for clients is very different. But there are some golden principles, I think, that we've carried through. And I think that that's kind of important to touch upon. Do you want to start there?
Yeah, what hasn't changed, right?
Yeah. Like what's still relevant and what's going to continue to be relevant moving forward?
Sure. It's a good question. There's a few things. I actually got an email. I got an email last night making an introduction to another CEO of an agency. And she wants to interview CEOs about retainers. Like, Retainer fees, like agencies are suffering, like agencies are struggling, which is something which is interesting to talk about. And I'm talking about COVID. Agencies were hit hard. There was unprecedented rounds of layoffs across the board, especially in New York agencies. Big time cuts, clients leaving in droves, money being delayed. So this CEO wants to put together like, I don't know, it's a podcast or a blog post or a book about retainers, like how you could change or restructure or creatively fix your retainers to keep making money as an agency in the post-COVID era. And she's like, can we interview you? So I was like, sure. And like my first thought that came to my head was like, just do good work. That's never changed. You have to do really good work. And work to me is not just like your headline. It's your client communication. It's how you present yourself. It's your effort. It's your integrity with a client. It's your likability. It's all these things that go into good work. People try to focus on fixing things that seem easy to fix, like Band-Aids, you know, putting a Band-Aid on something. It's much harder to reassess the fundamental groundwork of your business. It's similar in a lot of ways to the clients that come to us. And they're like, well, we think our whole issue is like, we just don't have our ad group structured properly. If we could just get our ad group structured properly, you know, we're going to do great. And it's really easy. We just need an expert. And I was like, no, you don't. Like, you have a terrible product. You have no clue where you stand in the price value matrix in your industry. And that's hard damn work to have to face, which is like, okay, distribution, services, products. It's like, it's not about restructuring your ad groups a lot of the time. So I think that hasn't changed. It's like, being able to be brutally honest with your own flaws, being able to look and say, here's the work cut out for us. This is where we're really lacking. This is where we need to get to be successful or to have something which is viable from a business perspective. I think that hasn't changed. Although a lot of things have changed, but what do you think?
So I would say on the do good work mantra, so I spend a lot of time with you. I know what you mean by that. I think to somebody else, that might seem just like a platitude, so yeah, to speak. But I think what you're getting at is doing challenging work. And I think that's something that, you know, we've seen a lot of companies and a lot of agencies struggle. And I think the bottom fell out on a lot of people that were not willing to do the challenging work. That, you know, a client came in the door and said, you know, this is what I want you to do. And it's a task-based type of relationship. And they just put their head down and, mm-hmm, and they did it. And they didn't like ask why, or they didn't, you know, try to dig deeper into the business and actually try to provide real value for their client. And I think that those are the people that suffered a significant amount over the last couple of months. So I think it's more about doing the challenging work and really digging deep and to trying to figure out like, yeah, like we're a digital advertising agency and people in their minds hire us to do XYZ tasks. Yeah. But, you know, we approach it in a completely different way, trying to really solve top level business problems, even if it is coming down to restructuring an ad group.
Right. Challenging work, why it's so hard. And I think I fall prey to the same issues. Like, I know we need work on our website and I know that we need to restructure. Like, just the other week when we started working on this discovery call deck, mm-hmm, right? Like, it's a big process change. It requires, first of all, you're going into the unknown. It's like, I don't know how this is going to come out. Our first client calls are challenging. They're difficult. There's a lot of information we need. The client is coming to the table with a whole backpack of psychological and issues and drama and what they're looking for your mistakes. It's difficult. It's a new relationship. It's like a first date. Money has been exchanged, which ups the ante. It's not a simple thing. So it's like, okay, well, we had some sloppiness and we had some issues and we know we could always improve. And it's like, well, I would much rather run a split test on a headline on our contact us page. I was like, that's easy. And it's also easy to convince yourself that that's important or like that's the work you need to do for the next 3 hours this afternoon. It's challenging to be like, we have a serious procedural opportunity to become better at the service we offer. And it translates the same thing to a company that sells products. And it was not easy. It was like, I think it was probably like 3 weeks I didn't say anything about this. And it's like, okay, well, we really need to do this. Let's make a slide deck. Let's figure out exactly how we're going to restructure the discovery calls. Let me sit in on these discovery calls, even though sometimes it's like causes me anxiety, especially with the new team members. But I think that like that's the challenging type of work I think you're talking about, which I think every company should be more willing to face.
And with that, right, so that process, it's sort of a small thing in the grand scheme of the business, right? So it's like, okay, we bring a new client on board, we have this first phone call, and we think that there's always an opportunity to make this process more efficient. We've onboarded hundreds of clients over the years, and this is something, when I first joined the company in 2015, we would hire a client, or a client would hire us rather, and we would just start working on their campaigns and like set up a next call with the client without having any background information. So the first step that we acknowledged was, okay, we should start somewhere. We should have a first conversation. And that developed into basically 5 years worth of improvements to that process of onboarding, making it smoother, better expectation setting. And now we finally reached a point where, okay, well, we want to have a visual presentation to guide us through and make a more structured process here. And it seems like a small thing, but it is a big undertaking. It's the first impression that you're giving with a new client. The stakes are incredibly high. Money was just exchanged and we haven't done anything yet. And that's why it really is important to get it right. And the process that you took for it was you brought in two of our more senior team members and you said, this is the idea, go figure it out, talk to me in a week.
Right.
And the three of you sat down, I was kind of sitting in the back of the room, just kind of observing, and you and Ronnie Nakama were basically arguing with one another about what this deck should be and what should it include. And like Ronnie was saying like, no, like you think that this is going to be that way. Like we're not including that in the deck. And you guys went back and forth and everyone kind of came to a resolution. I think that we finally have a really nice product that we've started using on these calls. Still a lot of work to be done, but I think it's good. So kind of embracing that, like really, hey, this is a challenging project. It's going to take a lot of time, a lot of effort. And we're all going to, it's going to lead to some tense, uncomfortable conversations. But at the end of the day, it's necessary for us to make that marginal gain for the relationship with the client.
And if I could extract two insights that I think are useful from this story, because we started talking about what hasn't changed, right? And we spoke about hard work, challenging work, like having a really brutally honest assessment of yourself, of your business. But then it's like, okay, well, how do you do that? Or if you're struggling with that. And I think that people tend to think that discontent or a dissatisfaction with yourself is mutually exclusive with a feeling of pride and satisfaction and accomplishment. It's like, and it also, it makes sense. It's logical that those two things cannot both coexist. It's like, I either feel really good about myself and I'm like accomplished and I need to feel that way and I'm happy because that's what gets me through the day. I have a high, you know, a good sense of self, self-esteem. Or I feel discontent and I feel like I could be doing better and I haven't done enough. And I don't think it's true. I think human beings absolutely could exist in such a paradox, and it's important to exist in that paradox, is that at the same time, you could feel discontent, dissatisfied, I didn't do enough and I should have done better. And at the same exact time, feel filled with pride and joy and satisfaction and accomplishment. And that feeling, being able to train yourself to feel both of those at the same time, is what will produce a capacity to face and dive in to the very, very difficult, challenging work. Because you really need both. If you're just feeling good about yourself, then I feel great. It's time to retire. Right. Like, what do I need to go challenging work for? If I just feel bad about myself, it's like you don't have any motivation anymore. It's not positive motivation. It's just like, I feel negative. What's the point of trying?
Yeah.
But if you feel both those things at the same time, it's like, I'm a great person. I've done great work, but I suck at the same time.
I agree. And I have a few different points on that, because I think that that's a really good way to describe. It really is a paradox. And we have a newer team member that came to me recently, and you know, she's starting to have work pile up. And she had said, she was like, you know, I'm starting to feel overwhelmed. What do I do? And my response to it was bordering. I was like, well, that's really good. I'm glad that you feel overwhelmed. Like, I wish you didn't. I don't want you to feel pain and suffer. But at the same time, it's important that you realize that and that you do feel pressure, because that's when you perform at a high level. Like a bit of anxiety, in a way, just a small amount, is really what produces high level work. It makes you cognizant of all these different variables. It forces you to be creative. It forces an extreme attention to detail, which is probably the most important attribute of the work that we do. And so we worked through and said, look, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed. So here's how we're going to tackle that. But also at the same time, this is good, which is a really, really weird thing. And David Ogilvy, who's like father of modern advertising, as you might describe, he has a handbook that used to be given all Ogilvy employees. And I have a copy of it in my office.
Did you get that idea from us?
No, I think we got that idea from him. Uh-huh. But the actual title of the book, the handbook, is The Eternal Pursuit of Unhappiness.
I love it.
And in it, he sums up and he talks about this concept of divine discontent, mm-hmm. and never actually being satisfied with your work. And it is a paradox. And he said, divine discontent is an antidote to smugness. And I think that being smug and being comfortable is probably the most dangerous thing that somebody can have in a career.
It's a big turnoff to clients too.
Exactly. I talk about it all the time, especially with newer team members. Best career advice I got in my life was, I had an internship at a large retailer. And twice a year, the district manager comes in, does a walk of the store and does this whole thing, whatever. And there was a rising star, assistant store manager. She had moved from Virginia to New York to come like kind of get the experience in the New York fast-paced environment. And then she was going to be, you know, she was on a track for success in this company. And the district manager came in and I was walking alongside them. He said, listen, Aisha, you're doing great. You know, the company's really excited about where you're going. However, and he stopped and looked her dead in the eye and said, don't get comfortable. Don't let any of the success, don't like let this pat you on the back, whatever. The stakes are higher than ever because, you know, you have this expectation set for you. And I just happen to be a bystander. This advice wasn't directed at me. But that level of don't get comfortable is something that I carry with me every single day. And it sucks because it's overwhelming at times and it's creates anxiety.
Like, you do have that, because I've worked with you closely for 5 years. You do have a sense of divine discontent, as I do, and I like
that.
It's
funny to hear that. You know, you are unhappy, is really what you're saying.
You're miserable. You're miserable. You're miserable to be around also. But do you think that you have that innately, or maybe that advice from your manager triggered it or revealed it or actualized it, or do you think you didn't have it and hearing it from your manager created it within you?
I think part of it's innate. But I do think a lot of that is a product of your environment. I think a lot of these types of habits and skills, I think they can be developed over time. I think it's really a mindset and an attitude of like, oh, that seems like good advice. I'm going to start thinking about how that's relevant to the work that I do. Mm. And you just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And over time, it becomes who you are. I don't think, when I was in high school and college, I don't think I lived that way. I don't know, maybe I did, but I think that you needed to have it reinforced, and then you needed to realize that it was good advice, and then how can I put this into practical application? Yeah. I really do think it is something that could be learned.
Yeah, interesting. I think there has to be something innate in a person to like have that feeling, and then it could be. And I think that the environmental element is big, because you see it all the time, where people adapt to the work ethic of their environment. Totally. You know, you have outliers of like, you know, there are certain people, any environment they're in, they're going to either they'll work hard or they won't work at all. But I think your average person is hugely impacted by the culture and the environment with mm-hmm. that they're in all day. The second thing on the whole discovery call slide deck story is creating an environment. So if you're a leader, so like, the, you know, I think the first element, which is internal motivation, is like a general psychological insight, healthy living. But from a leadership perspective, it would not have worked. Like this, the discovery call deck and changing our process and improving our process for these initial client phone calls would not have worked as well if the environment here was one of fear, which is interesting because fear has to be defined. Fear doesn't mean that good work isn't expected and really high quality work isn't expected. And I think we could talk, this is a funny story, because see, I could have done the whole thing myself, which I didn't have the energy and I didn't have the capacity or the intelligence to do at this point. It's like, I need other people's input. It'll be better. It'll be better if we have other people's input. But at the same time, the way it worked was I brought in other people for this project. And those people, I think because of the environment we have, had absolutely no fear to voice their ideas, right. to voice a bad idea, to tell me that my perspective on this point was wrong and they couldn't disagree more for X, Y, and Z reason. And then for me to shoot back with my feelings about it and then to have a discussion where it's like, you know, out and out, three of us, four of us really having it out to figure out the best way to do this damn thing. But in an environment where people who work for you are afraid of either a bad idea, right, being ridiculed, or of telling quote unquote a superior, is that what you call it, somebody who works above you, is that what it is, like telling a superior
I think that's what you would refer to it as, yes,
telling a superior that, like, I think if I open quote, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, end quote, boss. Those types of environments 10 times out of 10 times will stunt creative output. And like, this is something which is not, you know, we're not no groundbreaking advice here. Like, this has been shown to be the case over and over, especially in creative fields, especially. Like, it's those types of boundaries are the worst things in the creative fields or the creative disciplines. But again, there's another paradox, because you could emancipate people from fear and at the same time expect good work. Because I had, initially I emailed one of the team members involved. I said, okay, listen, get this to be 80% good. This is what I wrote in my email. Yep. Get it to be 80% good. Then talked about it. Then review it with Patrick, you, and then bring it to me. And then we'll review it again. So he didn't really read that email that closely, because a few days later, a day later, he sent me some slide deck that had nothing resembling the initial thing that I had outlined. It wasn't reviewed with you. And I was critical of that. And he went back and read the original email and apologized, and we had a laugh about it, but was still as forceful. Crazy
thing. By the way, I was on that email thread. That exchange was back and forth of him not realizing that he didn't even read, and then saying like, oh, it looks like I didn't actually read the fine details of that. And then you guys are kind of going back in this email thread, and I wasn't in the office that day, and I honestly thought that you guys were playing a prank on me. It like played out as if it was like a Monty Python skit, like a who's on first or whatever.
It's hilarious. And you would think that after, let's say, a mistake or dropping the ball like that, you'd be really like careful and timid. But that's not the case. It's not the case here. It's like, no, it's like, okay, well, you made a mistake. Like, we'll call that out and I'll be like, that's ridiculous. Now, it's not at all what I asked. Now let's get back to work. And you'll be equally as critical of me if I have a bad idea. But it's two things. It's one, it's you've emancipated the environment from fear, where good work could be done. No one's afraid of voicing a bad idea. No one's afraid of arguing with the other person. But it has to be done in the service of the final product. Mm-hmm. Because if you're arguing and you're being critical in any way, personal level, like the moment you'd be like, I always knew you couldn't come up with a good idea, you know, like that's a personal attack. And that's already like, okay, there's underlying problematic issues and that's not going to produce good work. But arguing, having an environment where it's okay to disagree, it's encouraged to disagree, it's encouraged to just throw out an idea which might be bad, which might be good, regardless where you sit in some fictitious or hierarchical bureaucratic structure, those are the environments that I think are A, the most pleasant to work with, because you get to produce good work, you get to argue, you get to say what you think, you're valued, you're sincerely valued, you get to be part of a team that's doing that together. It's a great feeling.
So, I mean, this could be an hour-long discussion, and I don't think we have the time for that. Is there a short way to describe, like, yeah, everyone says that. I think everyone would agree with you that that's the sort of environment that produces the best quality work. But do you have a very short but actionable bit of advice as to how to create that sort of environment?
I would say if you're 100% equally as self-critical and open to criticism and honest with your own mistakes as a boss, as a leader, as you expect and want your team members and your employees to be, you are 3/4 of the way to creating that environment. When your team feels over the years and over time working with you that if you make a mistake, you will own it as a boss. You will never deflect blame to somebody else. You will be open to other people's opinions as much as you are open to your own, which doesn't mean you can veto. You have veto power. You make a choice, you make a choice. Sure. But if you are authentically open to other people's opinions as much as you are your own, and you are as equally as self-critical of yourself as you expect your employees to be, I think that goes a long way in creating that environment.
I like that. That's actually a different spin on it than I would have started with. And I think that this is a component of it as well, that it really starts with having the highest quality people on your team.
That's for sure.
But I also think, to your point, like, you could have a bunch of A players, but if, you know, the person at the helm doesn't have that mentality that you just described, I think none of it works.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You have to have an A team. No question about it.
Excellent.
All right. That wraps up. This is good. I think a good start to episode 1, How to Hide a Dead Body. And we look forward to future episodes, great guests, powerful sponsors.
The more anecdotes from Danielle.
Yeah, the works. All right.
All right.
See you next week.